Assalamu alaikum, hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Retail Remix Stories. This is the place where you meet inspiring business leaders who through their massively transformative purpose are shaping not only their businesses, but also building piece of the future in the region and in the world. Our guest today is a person who I'm really envious about because he holds two seats at one time. He's the Chief Operating Officer and the Chief Technology Officer of a brand that was born in Dubai and is now making waves across the world. Our guest today is Mark Jeffrey, COO and CTO of The Giving Movement. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you for having me as well.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We've been talking about stories of inspiring leaders, right? And how they are building their businesses today. The starting point of all stories usually is once upon a time, there was a little boy called Mark.
Yeah.
So why don't we start there and help our listeners understand where you're from? What was your childhood like? Any key influences?
Sure, sure. I'm from a city called Dundee. It's the fourth largest city in Scotland. When I say largest, I'm talking about only 200,000 people. So it's not exactly a huge city kind of thing. I grew up actually, I was kind of brought up by my mum and my gran actually. So while you would think that would put me in a bucket of being a bit of a timid kind of kid, it was quite the opposite. And so when I was younger, I guess I was potentially playing two parts or living two lives, where on one side I was a bit of a geek where I was into gaming, watching films and things as well. I was obsessed with, you know, films and music and gaming. On the other hand, I was out mucking about with my mates, you know, causing trouble. Getting up to no good. While I like to say we all grew up, I still feel young. I still feel like, well, I still got up to no good. But over the course of, my childhood, tech in general, something that I have a passion about now, obviously, was definitely prevalent for the whole time. I used to joke with my mum a lot that I used to kind of constantly break her computer. She bought this computer. She was doing this postgraduate degree later on in life, and she had this old Windows 95 computer, and I'm constantly on it, breaking things and things. I was only, you know, a young kid at the time, maybe, you know, 7 or 8 year old onwards kind of thing like this as well. And from then I've always been a bit of a tinkerer, always into electronics, technology in general. And but that wasn't actually how I started my career. I made a big kind of move. When I was younger, there was either two paths. You could be a tradesman, as I like to call it, where you get into kind of trades, you know, kind of there's like 3-4 buckets of, you know, you either get into electrical work, you get into kind of plumbing, joinery and things like this as well. You go into that spectrum, or because that was in demand back then, or you go university track. And so when I wanted to go to university, I'd actually signed up for what we call mechatronics, which is kind of like robotics and electronics together.
Amazing.
And I got in, everything was good to go, but last minute, I decided, you know, my mates and everything were all out, you know, mucking about, doing things, and everybody was traveling, and there were jobs. They were only, you know, young, 16, and they already had a salary. And I wanted to go to Ibiza. I wanted to do things with my mates. I wanted to, you know, do all these things. And I realized if I went to university, I wasn't from a really well-off, my mom was, you know, paycheck to paycheck, not in a bad way. You know, she's a teacher now, and she did a higher education later on in life. But, you know, it was a lot tougher back then, let's say. And I guess I wanted to, you know, since I was younger, I was very independent in a way, and I wanted to do my own thing. So I decided to actually let me go into electrical side of things. And so that's what I started doing actually, is electrical installation. I used to travel all around Scotland, installing like backup generator systems, doing commissioning for big rigs and offshore platforms and things, but they were parked up, you know, onshore. So that was my beginning of the journey. And when I was about 21, I decided that I wanted to go offshore. I wanted to travel overseas, at which point I went away and did some kind of courses and things like this as well, that you had to kind of get these qualifications like rope access and this compex thing and what like. And I did it all myself, did it all with my own expenses, with the hope of I'm going to get a job. And I got a phone call from Dubai, and I thought it was a bit of a joke. And the guy says, I think you've got everything that we need. Are you willing to come to Dubai? And at the time I was thinking maybe it'd be great to get a job in Spain or something, but then Dubai came up.
That's quite a leap.
Yeah. Dubai came up. So yeah, traveled to Dubai, 22 year old, didn't know anybody here. My mom and dad had actually visited on the way to Australia. So they kind of gave me a bit of a brief that I'd go for it, you know? So yeah, I came over. When the first company I worked for out here was essentially an oil and gas manufacturing company who was sending their equipment all over the world, and I was going to be part of the maintenance and commissioning team. So we would basically oversee some of the manufacturing, and then we would go over with a team, and I would kind of supervise and work with that team to install this kind of customized equipment offshore and onshore all over the world. So my first, I would say, five years. I used to travel everywhere to think. I've been to places like Papua New Guinea. I've been to Sakhalin Island, which is like an island between a disputed island between Russia and Japan. I've been to Yemen a dozen times. I've been to Iraq. I've been to Sudan, all over the Middle East. I've been to South America as well, Mexico and things as well, North America all over as well. So yeah, I've been, everywhere, honestly. It's been a,
So truly a global citizen, right? I think, is there any country that you've been to where, from where there's no representation in the UAE right now?
So I would say, what representation you mean, like?
Citizens living here in...
Yeah. I mean, I would say, Papua New Guinea for sure. I don't think I've ever met anybody from Papua New Guinea over here.
Oh, yeah.
But, honestly, it was great at the time, and my miles and that were good. You know, Skyward, it was gold every single year. I found out. And back then it was a lot different as well, to be fair. And yeah, you know, it was great at the time. But unfortunately, the travel gets to you, actually, after some time. I couldn't really, you know, keep a relationship. Things were a bit turmoil in my life. You know, some months I would be completely out with Dubai. I would be, you know, I traveled to a famous story was actually, I went to the time I talked about when I traveled back from Papua New Guinea. I arrived back in Dubai. 2 days later, I had to travel to Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean and then come back to Dubai again. And I got a call to go to Russia. So I was like, so it's like,
what is your title, Prime Minister?
Well, they used to say, unfortunately, a few of the uprisings and things around about the Middle East, they just coincidentally happened. You know, I went to Libya and there was an uprising in Libya, you know, a week after I left, and similar with Yemen. And the guys in my company always said, like, what have you been up to there? Are you working for us or working for somebody else? You know?
Oh, my God.
So, it was fantastic. Loads of experience, you know, big part of my journey to where I am today. But in the back end of all this, I'm tinkering away, learning different programming languages, building things myself, doing some freelance work as well, you know, like part-time with like some online, you know, working on these online kind of channels and exist. They get some like freelancing work because my real passion is in tech. But unfortunately, another job opportunity came my way, which was one of our clients who used to operate the equipment on the oil and gas. So we were supplying the equipment and commissioning it. And then one of the ones who were the operator of that very equipment, they used to basically do essentially like when you're drilling into the ground, you basically need these downhole. Actually, the drill head is surprisingly not the most expensive part. You have these, the first couple of drill stems, the piping is actually full of like radioactive materials and different sensors and things as well. And they send up signals to the surface to let us know what's happening under the ground, like what kind of density is and things as of rock and what like. And then when they finally get to a point of they want to do some directional drilling, you know, there's a team for doing this as well. And then when they actually get some oil up, then there's a whole team to do the early sampling and things for the oil. So it was, you know, it was great to get that experience because I did that, some travel obviously with them as well. I did that for about 4 or 5 years. And and during that time, I was like, I need to get into tech. I need to, you know, I'm loving this, but oil and gas is so volatile and tech, you know, it's the time. So I decided that I wanted to kind of get a job in tech, but also realized that, you know, like maybe, you know, I needed to do something outside of my comfort zone. So I started a community in Dubai, actually, which was the Ruby on Rails community at the time. That was the kind of framework I was working with at the time. Uh-huh. That was the biggest in Dubai at the time. There's about 1,200 members. We used to do weekly meetings at one point. And since, you know, during that, when I was in the company, they were actually trying to buy an ERP system. And it was a complete, from the get-go, I mean, I probably shouldn't say the name, but anyway, from the get-go, the name was Lemon Software. And I don't know where I come from, a lemon is normally a dud, you know, like, I think they were trying to, you know, piggyback on the apple narrative, but, you know, a lemon is not exactly the best of fruits. You know? And it was a complete dud. And so what I did is I ended up spending a few weekends and nights for a couple of weeks and built my own ERP system and presented it to them. internally, but without bias of saying, I didn't tell them that I'd built it or anything. I just said that there is an ERP we could use it and showcased it. And they were like, "Whoa, this is amazing." So some of the head guys came over from Geneva, which is headquarters, and looked at this. It's the fastest software we've got. You know, there's 100,000 employees in this company. You know, this is amazing. You know, where could we get this from? I was like, actually, I built it, you know, and they're like, "Oh shit." You know,
wow. So super impressive.
What did we do here? And I said, like, well, you know, I could start splitting my time half-half. I'll do my job and, you know, get some support, but I'll invest half my time into building this thing out. And so it's still to this day, they're using it, even though I left years later, I'm still basically an advisor for that as well, which then led to my first tech role, which was with a company called EatApp. And they had found me actually through this for this Dubai community group. And they kind of said, like, what are you guys up to? And you know, we're starting a brand new company. And at the time I was expecting my first kid actually with my wife. And I said to her, like, if we don't jump ship now, I'm going to, you know, at the time we had a great pension scheme in oil and gas, you know, you have great insurance, you know, you get a car paid for you, multiple flights a year, and then moving to a startup, you know. So, so she agreed with me, thankfully, and I really appreciate that from my wife as well, that, like, if now's the time, you know, if you want to really get into tech, now is the time. So I'd already been working, giving them advice for about 6 months or so. And they're like, we need you on board. We need you to lead the team. This is like, you've basically, you know, built an infrastructure anyway, just doing part time. So you do come on full time, we're going to get some scary results.
Right.
So, joined them and, moved up the ranks while I was there. 2 years with the Giving Movement, but we could walk into that separately. But it was time. And even though, you know, I still advise EApp, and I'm still like a, you know, a shareholder in EApp and things as well. I joined very early. I you know, love what those guys do and really appreciate it. The team was fantastic as well. Now I've had to build a new team and you know, on a new journey as well, and it's e-commerce this time. And funnily enough, actually, when I went in for the interview process, one of my predecessor actually before me, the CEO before me, he hired me, and I was joining as the CTO at the time. And he asked me, you know, you got any e-commerce experience? I went, no, but, you know, I could pretty much do anything. And he kind of laughed. I went, I'm serious. Well, when I get serious, I can do anything. And he's kind of laughing. I said, okay, test me. And so they gave me kind of an assessment and things as well. And I was up against a few guys who were, you know, 15 years in e-commerce and obviously nailed it. So then they said, all right, let's give this guy a chance. You know, so
brilliant.
Let's go for
well
it.
Done.
So,
yeah. Well done. So I think one leadership skill, definitely, if you get your mind to it, you can do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Whatever I want to do. That's the passion matters. The passion matters.
Yeah, yeah, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's, you know, I know it was a long, long journey, but it's good to know all the ins and outs. And
yeah, no, I'm sure there's some kids out there who will really get inspired by listening to what Mark went through, right from... Of course, there's a glamour side of traveling 6,500 or 100 countries.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of hard work, right? You're burning the midnight oil.
Scary
almost work. 365 days a year, right?
Yeah.
And so coming to the Giving Movement, I think, like I was saying, it's a UAE-born brand.
Yeah.
There's a lot of prestige and honor around it. I think it's changing the paradigm from fashion being, you know, a style statement to actually becoming a movement.
Yeah.
And while we know, you know, some bits of it, would love to hear your views of what made you join the team at the Giving Movement.
I think it's funny as well, because when they first reached out to me, I was thinking, I don't know if it's for me. I think, like, because where we were at with EApp, we were into some deep tech. You know, we were building these customized protocols, which were, you know, a combination of offline synchronization, which was all custom built with WebSocket support and REST support. So it was crazy stuff. We were doing these things that have never been done before to turn, like, you know, the restaurants themselves, you know, you have an iPad, you have a desktop, and they want the iPad to be offline because the internet connectivity problems. So we were deep into the, you know, the stuff that I love, you know. Wow. We were like, and I was still coding, even though I was like VP, I was like, on it all the time. Just because, again, I would say, you know, one thing I did is, you know, over the course of my career, I like to call learn enough to be dangerous. Right. And so I constantly learn, you know, sales, marketing, everything, you know, and like I said, from my previous experience with oil and gas, there's a lot of project management as well. So basically coming into all this, I wanted to make sure that I was the best tech leader or engineering leader I could imagine. And I ended up, you know, listening to, for the best part of, there's a podcast called The Modern CTO and things as well. And then, you know, various other bits and pieces. But I particularly remember doing about 300 episodes of this Modern CTO, you know, over the course of my EAP to try and see how can I make the, you know, things better for the team and for tech in general. Like, how do I approach things? And so when I seen the Given movement, they were kind of using Shopify. And I was like, I don't know. It feels like there's no room for me here. You know, what am I going to do? And then when they start explaining the numbers and they start explaining the impact they're making and the things that they've done and how, you know, I'd be part of this, that's when things start changing. Actually, you know, maybe I won't be doing so much hardcore tech. Well, that's what I thought at the time, at least. But I'd be taking a different stance. I'd be learning, you know, e-commerce. I'd be getting into fashion, which I have no interest in, to be fair. But obviously now it's, you know, part of the parcel kind of thing. And I'd honestly be, you know, be part of a real thing. You know, it wasn't just, you know, SaaS, software as a service. It was, you know, we're actually, you know, we're donating massive amounts of money to charity. Everything we're doing is eco-friendly. And again, I don't come from a background of particularly caring about that stuff. And when I first joined, it was like, this is cool. But also it's not my like dream to join one of these kind of companies and anything else as well. But I thought, you know, at this point, I get to do tech, I get to be involved in this, and I get to learn e-commerce. Like, this is probably a winning combination here. So, you know, so obviously I took the job. And yeah, from you know, they say, you know, this book, The First 90 Days. And in that, he says, you know, don't make any harsh decisions in the first 90 days because you need to learn the business. Right. With the Given movement, they move so fast. Essentially, I signed the offer. Like, yeah, so build a strategy. So, I had to, you know, obviously they're impressed by the model that I built them in terms of how I would grow the team, how I would grow the tech team, anything else I would do as well. And, you know, what I would be looking at particularly funnel wise, marketing wise, everything. MarTech especially as well. There are massive problems with MarTech as well, operations and things like Omni and all this. And I went deep into the deep end. And at the same time, you know, I'm you know, I don't want to slack on EAP because I was leaving a team that I was sad to leave. I wasn't like leaving on any bad terms. In fact, like I said, I still work with these guys all the time. You know, they constantly call me for advice, and I was an advisor for a long time as well. So I was like, shit, you know, so I'd already, you know, informed my wife, unfortunately, that for the next few months, it's going to be tough. So I was literally, you know, eat up. So yeah, massive leaps and bounds since I first joined. It wasn't just, you know, speed and things like that. That's not what we only care about. It's part of UX as well. But we had a design team. We rebuilt the way that we do automation across all the different departments. As typical tech, in-house tech teams do, we're involved in everything. And and then obviously, you know, times changed and obviously, but, you know, even the BI, which when I first joined, it was scary. The data was just, you know, whatever query enemy wanted to create that day, unfortunately. And so we completely rebuilt that, hired an in-house team as well, which again, there was some people already in-house, but very junior. So we hired, a couple of senior guys came in, rebuilt everything using DBT and things as well. I had like the full infrastructure rebuilt from the ground up. I even built my own attribution model at one point.
Amazing.
So we did so many things with data. Now we're in this amazing place where I would say like the data hands down is one of the best in the region in terms of MarTech, in terms of automation and things like this as well.
So I think whenever you talk about tech, especially in the region, there's a lot of two pillars that really make tech work, right? One is talent, which you rightly said, you have a very strong team. The other one is where it comes to costs, right?
So yes.
I'd rather call them investments because just last week I was reading somewhere, it said smart tech moves money, but real tech makes money.
Yes.
So exactly. How do you kind of...
I would say hands down, and I'm not kind of blowing my own horn, but hands down, I'm probably the most commercially focused CTO in the market.
Absolutely.
And I've been to all the meetings and I can guarantee that, you know, I've been met many of the engineering leaders over here because, you know, what does it matter? You know, so many startups make the same mistakes. Just build. But it's not about building. You know, we all have a desire. And I have a desire. Let's build this thing custom. But then build versus buy, it's no longer about build versus buy. It's about, should we even do it in the first place? Should we do any of this stuff in the first place? What is it improving? You know? Right. And so a lot of the time we forget that we're either improving the leading indicators, the lagging indicators. You know, building something for the sake of being cool is no longer viable. People need to be profitable now. We can't have businesses are no, I mean, apart from AI businesses, no longer is anybody funding any business now, which isn't profitable, at least break even, you know, back in, you know, 2 years ago, it was like, yeah, you've got a cool idea. Let's throw some money on this problem and let's see what the hell happens. And then look what happened. The industry completely changed.
Yeah.
And everything changed. You know, the last couple of seasons, I always call them seasons, as in hiring seasons. Everybody gets fired in January and then they do all the hiring again. So the last couple of seasons, it's been tough. You know, even all the big social guys and that been firing on Facebook, everybody, because internally, pretty much is constantly back and forth. How do we organize the VM for one side, the content on one side, but also what does this little feature do that actually improve? And sometimes it is a bit of like, you know what, it's a quick one. It looks cool. Let's do it. But then there's like, you know, this is this big thing that we're doing. And why? And I always first want to say, why would we do that? What's the reason here? And we have this concept internally called short toes,
okay,
which essentially means, you know, you can't step on anybody else's toes because we've all got short toes. So feel free to say no.
All right.
So every all hands, stand-ups, guys, short toes. If you see something wrong in content, you see something wrong in tech, you see something, what are we doing here? Why are we doing this? You know, what makes sense here? And just kind of have this kind of healthy, challenging aspect. And that's, you know, and I credit to everybody actually, the whole company, including, you know, tech as well. There's a lot of feedback. We really, you know, give each other some tough feedback. And sometimes I'll be like, you know, this is shit, guys. What are we doing here? I don't understand. And they take it well because they know I'm coming from a good place. I'm not taking, I always say to them, feel free to veto me with data.
Yes.
Feel free to veto me with some kind of proof that I'm wrong. But I can guarantee you, I don't think this is going to work. And here's why. And if they come back tomorrow and be, you're wrong, Mark, because we've got the data and it says this, you know what? I'll eat my own shoe then. Fair enough. Let's do it. However, let's do V1, V2. You know, let's make a compromise. So there's always that kind of compromise. And the business out of me is like, yeah, let's not waste time on this because looking at the backlog, that's way more important. The team could challenge me anytime on this kind of thing. So
nice. And I think talking about tech, you can't not talk about AI.
Yes.
And that's one area where I think there's lots that's happening.
Yeah.
Like for example, the company I come from, Find, we're doing a design to shelf in 21 days.
Okay.
And something that we're working on, right? Things like these sound cool, but they need a lot of backend integration with factories and everything. So what's your opinion? I mean, not about design as a service, but largely on AI, what do you think?
The funny thing is, and this is what gets me, I constantly get, you know, bombarded with email requests and all sorts of stuff, you know, oh, yeah, we can AI the shit out of it. But what everybody doesn't realize is if you don't really have a solid data set or infrastructure, AI will do nothing. So like a lot of people will think, I'll just throw AI at the problem.
Right.
But then they spend 6 months trying to get the AI integrated. And by the time they do it, it's a loss, it's a sunken cost because the reality is I didn't even give them that benefit, if that makes sense. So what we did is to take a slightly different approach of, there's two versions of AI, in my opinion, in e-commerce and any brand. One is internal AI and one is external, like what we push into the customers. And so what we're pushing to the customers perhaps is like, you know, obviously Gen AI is big right now. And I don't know if you're aware, but we have our own in-house content team. We have our own in studio inside the office and things as well.
Yes.
We hire everybody in-house as well. And so we produce all our own content. I'm also overseeing this as well. And the content team do a fantastic job. You know, all of them are kick-ass. You know, I can't ask for, you know, a stronger team. Like all come from different angles, like BTS side, the UGC side, and they've all got tactical this, core that, you know, they're doing different kind of campaigns. And every single week we're thinking like, what could we do to improve? Because we have retouchers and things as well, you know? And so we're always thinking like, what could we do to improve this? But it's, I'll be honest, it's, every time we test it out, it's not quite there yet. And we find ourselves at the budget we've got, and because we do a lot of stuff in-house, we're just not finding this angle yet. Being a DTC brand, you know, we're a mono brand, not a marketplace. So for instance, in a marketplace, you could just create descriptions of products. You could perhaps create some images of products and that as well. But at D2C, we're only producing a few SKUs every single drop.
Yes.
So maybe not a few, but you know, a few hundred, for instance. So, you know, while we have and we've trained, you know, we've got our own GPTs and things as well to try and train it on how, the language we want to use for voice of the brand and things as well. We somehow feel like a human still do a better job at this point, you know, and especially when it comes to like, but almost what we've done now is we've augmented our process. So we've augmented certain things. So for instance, like resizing things or mass producing different quality, like aspect ratios or mass editing videos and things as well. We've started to use AI to perfect this. The actual content creation and things as well, because we're a DTC brand and we want to show how we do things in a certain way. We, you know, styling's a big part for us as well because our products is in this kind of space of lounge and active.
Yes.
We want to make sure that people know you can wear this stuff, you know, out and about. You can wear this stuff to work, not just, you know, to you know, a leisure activity or anything like that as well. So, you know, when we ask AI to do these things, unfortunately, it comes up with some really odd results.
Right.
So I think we're still a bit away yet from, you know, fully adopting it then. But what it does allow the team is we will use AI to, for instance, to plan some of the shoots and things. We use AI to help us to understand what would be a better strategy and how would we better optimize, you know, across like, you know, entertainment category of content, to the promotional category, to the inspiring category, things like this as well. So like, what are we doing wrong? How could we, here's an image that we put out and it didn't perform well on Meta, but performed well on Snap. What do you think? You know, and like, oh, well, you know, based on your previous, you know, catalog you gave me, then this one, the reason is the logo's not available. Like, yeah, you're right. You're right. You know, so it's helping us to augment our assumption of things, especially data as well. We constantly say like, here's all this data. We presented it in this way. The content feels strong, but it's not performing. And then we use AI to help us to understand what our assumptions, or validate our assumptions, if you like. So that's like the first part of it. But then the experience itself, you know, so retail experience as an, you know, in-store experience, a big thing that we're moving towards right now, you know, probably the end of this year, is this kind of, you know, first off, we've got our own iPads and things that we've built this kind of, it's all web-based because it's internal facing,
right.
But we built this in-house omni-channel CRM system because right. We all come from like CRM kind of battle. It was very quick for us to put this there, like a couple of weeks. And what happened is we want to integrate. So as people come into the store, you can ask for their phone number and then they give it, and we have all the online transactions, the in-store transactions right. as well. But what we want to do is kind of summarize recommendations for people. Right. So the staff are really good in retail to obviously make recommendations, but could an AI assist them and tell them, you know, like based on the previous spending behaviors, well, based on done, right? how long they've been around, show them this. So that's one of the things we want to do. And obviously cameras and things like this have evolved quite a lot now. And you get these kind of very advanced cameras that we want to link up to the system now, where they study heat maps and the VM, like the storefront. They also see like what gender people are, of the returning customers and things like this as well. So you're able to detect as people walk in, that's this customer, you know, this is how we should approach this person. They've previously bought this. You know, so it's really advancing to the point of, you know, are we evading privacy or is this cool to do this? You know, so, but right. obviously we want to do it in a way which is like a way that helps the customers, you know, and there's a recent study done from Amazon actually, who said, you know, the study, I can't remember how many thousand customers they studied again, but they asked customers, would you give us more data to help us personalize your experience? And 80% of them said, absolutely. Because everybody knows that the reality is, as long as we're a brand, we want this data to help us sell better to you in a non-spammy way. In fact, if we give you the value straight up right. without beating around the bush and showing you 1,000 different things, it's more friendly for the customer as well. So, yeah. So that's one big part we've got in retail coming down the road. And then online, obviously the personalized experience, everybody's pitching it. But the thing about personalized experience, in my opinion, especially when if you look at our app and you look at our experience on web and things as well, yeah, product recommendations, we've been using AI for a while for product recommendations things as well. But I think those days are, you know, unless we're doing something very experimental, I think those days are, you know, long gone. I think content personalization is where we're trying to get to.
Very,
you know?
So
one of the difficult parts about content recommendations is if you're Meta, if you're Snapchat, then it's easy. You look at cohorts of people who like all this content and cohorts of people who like that content. There's an overlap. These have some similar interests. Now we'll build an algorithm around that, you know, so likes and clicks and things. But for us, we're a D2C brand. You only see a few pieces of content on the experience. So we did three different ways of personal, like what we're planning to do is capturing the data first. So we started asking for people to tell us the preferences. So now at the end of the funnel, we ask them if, you know, what nationality, what they like to shop, the birthday and things as they understand right. the demographic, the age and things as well. But then we started, and in the funnel, you see little like messages pop up as you're scrolling down and be like, do you like to see more of this content and things as well, you know? And so we're trying to get a gauge of what people like. So that's like kind of behavioral wise, like what could we do? So that's customers willingly giving us data to help them personalize. But they're constantly thinking, you know, we understand that, you know, we started off at the beginning with a dream of what we wanted, and now we're following what customers are liking, but we also need to stay in line with trends. And you'll see it recently when we launched, the black cherry color, for instance, and that was, we launched it and we planned it for, you know, 9 months, and every brand was doing it, and we were like, this is great, you know, we're aligned, because when you know other brands are doing it, you actually know it's working, because that doesn't yes. mean that it's a copycat type of thing. It just means that we've got the season right, if that makes sense,
right?
And so yeah, I honestly, like I said, it's there's no, you know, we came from a time of fast growth, kind of startup mentality. And, you know, still to this day, we're small but mighty. We get shit done. You know, we're all about, you know, we all wear multiple hats, but we're also an established company. We can't compromise now on operations. We can't take risks with, you know, delivery times. We can't take risks with how we order fabrics and this as well. We're really doubled down on the back end way of doing things to the point of we've just onboarded some new tooling as well to help us do financial budgeting and things as well, to help us understand how to use certain fabrics in a certain way and a much more planned way and things as well. So we can optimize towards like overspending and underspending things as well. Because every, you know, we overspend and you think, oh, you know, we spent a little bit. And then so you compensate by underspending and then you have missed opportunities, you know. Yes. So it's this constant balance. So now we're kind of onboarding all these different tools to help us both to plan it, kind of like it's a manual augmentation of that, and then to automate it as well, to like do daily replenishments to retail stores based on what's happening and do kind of. So it's really fascinating space, I would say. Like the back end space is, obviously I'm really working closely with the guys on that, but credit to the team. The team is obviously also awesome. Like there's no way this is a, you know, a one or two man show. There's, you know, 100 people behind the scenes thinking about all the cool stuff that we need to automate, and everybody's on board, you know, in the sense that, you know, and a lot of companies, especially in fashion, it's like, yeah, it feels a bit weird that we're trying to be a bit tech empowered, kind of, you know, automated. You know, this is not the way we always did it. But, you know, while there's always some residue, everybody's like, yeah, let's go on. You know, we're small, but let's, you know, be better if we could produce a bigger bang for buck.
Yeah.
And so everybody's on that same track. And the team, honestly, big credit to the team. It's like everybody's, whenever we come up with some radical thing, like, can we just use this tool? And like, that'll take us a long time to onboard, but yeah, if it's how's this kind of benefits, then let's do it, you know. Yeah. So everybody's well, maybe it's part of my strong coercion as well, like this tool's for us, you know. But also I think, you know, they are willing to you know, change their way of working and things like that very, very rapidly as well, which is what you need, you know, especially in this time. So back end wise, we are super sophisticated, I would say, in a lot of ways. Like I said, our own OMS system, which kind of operates, you know, multiple inventories. It does multiple operations. It does like even some marketing and things as well. You know, does some like kind of transactional marketing things as well. And yeah, like honestly, like I said, credit to the kind of trading team as well. They constantly, very stressful. I'm involved in all these meetings as well. Every day the numbers are like this, down like that. You know, you're constantly battling everything, changing on a rapid basis. There's no downtime, unfortunately, you know. So it's really like the product team, there's one half of the office planning 1 year ahead and there's one half of the office planning Nick tomorrow, you know. Okay. It's literally like that. It's
what's your long-term strategy? Live tomorrow.
Yeah. And so, you know, while we plan, we forecast our whole budget for the whole year in terms of what we're going to earn revenue-wise, but we have to optimize towards it. You know, we, you know, recently, you know, again, no blame, one of the social platforms had an issue with their catalog. So for 3 weeks, we were missing some catalog attribution. Oh shit, you know? So then we have to plan and respend and reforecast and do everything. So there's always this, you know, hurry to like solve things, especially on the marketing side, you know? So yeah, it's very much a week on week, day on day. Are we on plan? And if not, like, let's pivot. You know, we've got this backlog of things that we're ready to go in case we need them, you know?
Wow.
Whereas on the other side of the office is like, yeah, we know we're buying for, you know, autumn, winter already, you know?
Wow. So, what a high energy place it must be.
Yes. And you know, unfortunately, not unfortunately, I guess it's a good challenge to have, is I'm involved with both sides of the equation.
Yes.
The founder, he kind of runs the product side of things overall, but we have obviously a lot of senior product team as well. But I just help out more on the operation side and I help out more on the content side, like support based on what we need. So I'm jumping between also, you know, this long-term planning, thinking about this and then another meeting like, oh yeah, this thing went down yesterday. Right, okay, you know, so it is amazing, but also very, very challenging for sure. Yeah.
Like I said in the beginning, it's an envious place, but it's also a dangerous place, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Everybody who joins, we make it very clear, guys, this is like a war zone, you know, like when you come in, you're in the trenches, you're going to be asked to do things, you know, we obviously try and balance work-life balance, but at the end of the day, whatever we don't accomplish, goes straight out the pocket of somebody who really needs it, because we do a lot for charity and things as well. So we really try and like, we're going to nail this, guys. The brand is so important. You know, we're going to do this. We'll be ambitious. We're going to do this. And a lot of people, you know, they'll say like, oh, you know, this is my lane. There is no lane here. You know, if there's nobody else to do it, you're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I absolutely strongly believe, again, going back to this, you know, and learn enough to be dangerous. I know everybody's not comfortable with it, but like sometimes you just have to put on a different hat and get shit done. And as they call it, GSD, that's the common term.
Oh, right.
Bring to every company that I join. It's like, yep, yeah, I know it's tough, but it's for 2 weeks and you just need to do it. And you know, we'll figure out what we do afterwards, but you know, everybody has to wear a different hat and just get on with it, because at the end of the day, if you can't do it, who else is going
to
do it? You
know? Amazing. So, I'm going to title this episode hashtag GSD.
Yeah. I'm sure a few of my ex-colleagues and even my current colleagues will laugh about that as well. Yeah.
Amazing. I think one key theme is sustainability. I think outside of AI, there's a lot of conversation around sustainability.
Yes.
And most of the times, sustainability is just a buzzword with most organizations is trying to, you know, pass off as sustainable. Either there are cost considerations or no true value that's being driven.
Yeah.
But the giving movement is actually built on the basis of sustainability, right?
Yes. It's sustainability, we don't use that word anymore because we realize that people get a bit too serious when it comes to sustainability. And so we're fully certified in terms of all our materials. Everything comes from ethical sources with no kind of sweatshop things and scenarios. All of our fabrics are organic, least pesticides as possible. It's all recycled as well where possible. So pretty much everything is 100% recycled, organic to any extent that we can do. So all of our sourcing comes from that angle. But then when it comes to things like, you know, if you want a lot of brands in the US and things got kind of hammered because they weren't doing, for instance, carbon emissions offsetting, we explored it. It cost an absolute fortune. We attempted to do it all. We realized over time that, you know, it's something we should strive towards, but it's not something we should claim that we're, you know, end-to-end sustainable. But whatever we do is on an eco-friendly. So we kind of changed the word into eco-friendly focus. Like we want to, you know, fashion as, you know, as an example, a lot of fashion brands, when they have like, stock that's, you know, we have like a few thousand items at the end of one season, we either, you know, sell off at discount. A lot of fashion brands will say like, oh, just, you know, throw it in the dump. We don't do that. We keep it and we'll donate it or something like this as well, or we'll have to ethically dispose of it in a way that makes sense for the environment. So we're kind of holding ourselves to a very high standard,
right?
That I don't think anybody actually realizes. But again, we don't want to be overzealous and be like, yeah, we're sustainable from end to end. We are more sustainable than the large portion of brands out there. But again, sustainability is a kind of a vague and dangerous word, because a lot of people have, you know, are you doing this? Are you doing this and doing that? And while we try and do everything, we also have to make money, because another angle is if we don't make money, we have to pay charities and things as well. You know, I would say, you know, a bigger focus today is more on the giving back. You know, it's very, very much in the name as well. Right. And giving back is where we are absolutely, that's our number one. You know, homegrown obviously is a big part of our USP as well. You know, all our factories and things are in the UAE. I don't know if you're aware of that as well. So we produce all our products in that, and our large portion of, you know, most of our products in the UAE. And so, yeah, like homegrown, giving back. And then this angle of eco-friendly is our kind of third USP, if you like. And unfortunately, you know, while the fashion industry was very big on that back in the day, when we did some consumer focus groups again, we realized that people are not so concerned about that nowadays. So while we as a brand, we will continue to do eco-friendly, it's maybe not as ambitious as it used to be. And not because we don't care, it's just that also we need to actually, you know, we're a private business. We still have to, you know, we still have to report to the board profits, right? And we still have to make money so we can pay charities. So it's more of a, you know, we do everything possible, basically. So
yeah, and you're being true to it, right? So you're not claiming things that...
No, absolutely. And like I said, like all of our stuff is a fully certified things as well. And that's what we're kind of, you know, it's surprising as well, because a lot of people will say it, but then they've got nothing approved. We've actually do all the test certificates from third parties and things as well, outside of the, you know, like we have our factories and we have our fabric suppliers and we do all the certification, but absolute third parties, independent third parties, to make sure that there is no funny business going on. And we've actually, you know, disqualified fabrics in the past. We're like, actually, like, there's something a little bit off here. You know, we're going to have to reconsider this order and things as well. So as we get the samples in, for instance, before we order the bulk, we'll do a sample test on it. And then we realize that we're not going to order this bulk, guys, because it doesn't fit to our sustainability standards or our eco-friendly standards. So, you know, we can't take the bulk order. We're going to go with another supplier. And so we've done that in the past as well. So we do stay to those pieces of the puzzle. Yeah.
Nice. And so I think coming to our last segment, from a, you know, 2030 or 2035, what do you see happening in this space, right? Because there's a lot of other brands which will try to, you know, imitate, copy, or try to compete with you.
Yeah.
And what do you see this space actually moving out to be in the next 5 to 10 years?
You mean like fashion in general or TGM or how do you think?
I think TGM, yes, for sure.
Yeah.
And largely, how do you see technology influencing other brands in trying to catch up with TGM?
Yeah, I think everybody's, you know, we constantly benchmark what everybody else is doing as well. And everybody, I think, is on the similar track to what we're on, I would say, or thinking like that. Now, I know what you're saying, like copycat brands, you know, there's a lot actually, unfortunately. And I think like, you know, every well-established brand, and we've only been here for 5 years, so it's quite good that we're already well-established, to be fair, is going to have some element of counterfeit products and things as well. And we constantly are, you know, visiting different, I won't name the places in Dubai, but constantly visiting different areas of Dubai to, you know, yank those counterfeit products in as well. But, you know, it will always happen. We even use AI tools, funnily enough, as well.
Yeah,
we use a third-party service. And again, I won't name the name in case it's a bit of a trade secret. We use that, and that searches certain websites, especially around the world, and it'll look for products which sound like us or use our brand name and even images that look like ours and do takedown notices.
Right.
And so, because we see that all over, especially in marketplaces like secondhand marketplaces and things as well, where people think, oh, we'll just claim it's like secondhand, but they're selling them as brand new, so it's not secondhand, if that makes sense. You know,
right.
So, but it's obviously counterfeit. So we do a lot of work to stop that, but in the end, you know, it will unfortunately always happen, or they'll create some variance of what looks like us, but it's not exactly like us and things as well. But moving forward, like, where does the horizon go? I think TGM is a brand. You know, we are strong on fashion, and we want to continue to grow on fashion. We want to go into probably some other categories as well. Kind of things you would wear at nighttime, casual wear and things as well down the road, no doubt. But the, you know, the horizon is wide, actually. You know, like, we, and again, we're not going to just jump into something for the sake of jumping into something, but what we stand for is something meaningful, you know, and what we do is shown to be impactful. You know, we've got, you know, building schools in India and things as well. It's crazy. You know, very, very significant efforts being made across the board, including we donate actually to the Gaza humanitarian aid as well just now. So we do a lot of cool stuff, and you know, I think that the brand stands for something a bit more, and not just fashion. And I think, and again, I won't give any away, but I think there's so many different verticals you could get into if you wanted to, because when you have such a powerful brand, then it makes sense, you know, and what do we get into, you know, it's still to be figured out, I would say, but it doesn't mean to say we'll only stick in our lane, if that makes sense. We could always experiment with other lanes as well, in small ways that we could see, test out the waters. But other fashion brands, for sure, are there. Everybody's going into this, you know. Unfortunately, Temu and you know, all these guys in it as well, as Shein and things as well, are have brought this whole new spectrum of compete. You know, they don't compete with us. They don't compete with any kind of our brands and our price. We're you know, premium. Well, we actually call us a bridging brand. So what that means is, we're kind of like this. We like to call it, and the fashion industry, not just us, is accessible luxury. So we're not luxury, and we're not premium. We're kind of just slightly above that in terms of our price point and you know, our in-store experience. I want to invite you down as well to our new City Walk store. It opens in a couple of weeks. This is absolutely next level store. This is going to be a flagship store, next level. It's got like rivers and everything going through it. It's crazy stuff, you know, really cool. So the experience, you know, the luxury feeling, but the price point is accessible. So that's what we call it, luxury, accessible luxury. We don't compete in the space with them, but we call ourselves a bridging brand, as in people who buy luxury products use us for their day-to-day, and people who don't buy luxury products use us as their kind of, like, their luxury product.
Right.
Like, you know, so it's called a bridging brand. That's actually a term from our head of merchandise. And she's actually like really good at kind of coming up with these naming conventions and things as well. So that it was, you know, I learned this term when I first joined, let's say. And but yeah, essentially, if you're in this bridging brand space, then Temu and that is not really in our space. However, they do erode the customer's expectations. They do erode, because everybody's thinking, yeah, you get like this thing for like 12 dirhams, you know. So then it erodes people's expectation, thinking, absolutely, you know.
That's good.
And then things like as well, we've heard all the rumors, and again, I don't know how much is true, is like the stuff that we're producing is they're not ethically sourcing things as well. So of course, what happens is the consumer spending behavior says, I can get stuff really cheap. So why not, you know? And so, This is the all fashion brands are facing now. So what we have to do, along with the other kind of mono D2C brands, is we have to amp up our game in terms of make the experience feel even better. So our mission right now is to be better experience, both, like, you know, online as in top of the funnel and in the funnel as well. The experience needs to be stellar, you know, better on every single level. The content needs to be next level. The personalization needs to be next level. Everything that we do, our activations, our brand marketing, because much like most other brands in this space, that's what they're having to do, because you have to be so different from that space that it almost is a clear cut, if that makes sense, you know. And so we clearly carve out our ICP customer profile, you know, right. And they have their own, you know, and that's the, you know, it needs to be a clear cut, unfortunately, you know. So that's the difference. And now, again, there's nothing wrong with fast fashion in a sense that, you know, it's consumer friendly, but also it does mean there's a lot of wastage and things as well.
Right.
You know? So fast fashion is purposely like it's like fast food, you know, it's got that kind of, this kind of overarching kind of like rain cloud kind of all over the top of it kind of thing. But we're in much more of a space where we're, you know, we're much more kind of premium fashion, if that makes sense. We need to amplify that without amplifying the prices so much, if that makes sense. You know, so the experience needs to be super luxury, super premium, omni-channel, everything needs to be next level. So when people come in, they feel good. And that's like one of our things is that we're comfy, but you also feel good wearing us because what we stand for and how we present ourselves needs to be to that caliber, essentially, or we hold ourselves to that caliber, I should say, you know, so that's definitely our big target.
Awesome. I see you there in safe hands. I think the brand is in safe hands, seeing your passion around it. I think we're to the last segment, quick leadership nuggets. Maybe we'll do this in a rapid fire way.
Yeah.
The first thing that comes to your mind. So maybe a book that every entrepreneur should read.
Good question. Actually, I read one recently, which was absolutely fantastic. It's called Amp It Up, I think it is.
Amp It Up.
Yes. And I think I read it actually twice, to be fair, over the past couple of years. And yes, the guy who was joining with Snowflake and exists as well, who kind of joined as a CEO in multiple companies and that as well, and just radically changed into full execution mode. Because like a lot of people, you know, there's a great strategist, Roger Martin things as well, talk about is like strategy is only good as execution. And I'm a big believer of, you know, let's spend a lot of time building a kick-ass, you know, bulletproof strategy, but it means nothing without execution. And that's what he's all about. He's like, come in, execution. And that is the most important thing, because you could talk about all the stuff you want, but it's not about talking the talk, it's all about walking the walk, you know? So I think like that book has really got me like, whoa, this is, you really need to be clear cut. You really need to just start removing the fluff, removing all the crap, if that makes sense, you know, focusing on what matters and making impact instead of just thinking about things, you know.
Yeah. So,
and I think, again, back to the GSD mode, that's what it's all about.
Amazing. Yeah. Any piece of advice that you've received in your life from anyone that's kind of molded you to be the person you are?
I think I wouldn't say it's from like any one individual, but I think over the course of my time that my, like as I've moved it through different careers and things as well, that my leaders that I have aspired to be are both friendly and ruthless, if that makes sense, you know? So I think there's a good combination of, you know, no assholes, but also actually this is a business, we all need to be professional and we accept there's no exceptions on this kind of thing. So I think like I always try and be super friendly, but when somebody's kind of taking the piss, I'm happy to say like last chance straight away. Because no assholes.
Right.
I've got a big, you know, pet peeve about ass, because one poison pill poisons the whole water, you know?
Right.
And so I think, you know, last chance always, you're acting like an asshole. If you don't get your shit together, this is it. You know, it's not about performance always. And a big thing I've seen is like, be super friendly because you want to build a great culture. And that's what, you know, that's what I always do. But if somebody's poisoning that culture, like one chance only, and then that's it.
And that's it.
Yeah. So, and I think those leaders, everybody gets with because they know where they stand. Like, this guy's not going to braid me in front of people. I never, you know, jump on people's back or any of the things. I'll say like, what's the problem here? How can we solve this together? And as long as they always say, I'm working on it, I'm trying to get a problem solved, and things, it's like, oh, it's not my responsibility. That's it. I'm already like, okay, I'm on top of this guy. And it's about how he recovers from it. And then other people who are gossiping and causing, you know, behavioral bits and pieces behind people and us as well, that's again, you're verging it in the space of you're not committing and you're also being an asshole. So you've got no time for it, you know.
Yeah.
So I definitely think like my you know, leaders that I've both dreaded and also admired, dreading as in they're not friendly whatsoever, they're far too by the book, and I think that's not a right move as well. I think you need a friendly, very, you know, culture that everybody wants to come to work in the morning.
Like, right.
I can't stand anything more than coming to work like, oh no, I can't bear speaking with this guy one more. That's not what I want whatsoever. And yet also I better not disappoint this guy because this guy's going to be super pissed if I disappoint him. So it's that balance, if that makes sense, you know. So
amazing. I can keep talking to you all day long. Thank you very much, Mark. Before we go, where can our listeners and viewers follow you, and where can they follow the Giving Movement?
To be honest, I'm not a big social media user. So I do it for work. I've got a couple of kind of fake accounts I do just to experience the platform. So I'm not big in social media. I feel it's just a big distraction, unfortunately. So, but LinkedIn, you can find me on LinkedIn. I think it's just mark.jeffrey18, if I'm not mistaken now. So you can always like connect with me there. In terms of the Giving Movement, I think Instagram is the best place. You know, if you go search for the Giving Movement on Instagram, got like millions of followers, and you can see all the latest content drops and all the latest messaging things as well, and what we're doing, stores open and things like that as well. So I think that's probably the best place to come and find us as well. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mark, for making time for us today. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Along with that, don't forget to follow us on the Retail Remix page on LinkedIn and follow us for e-commerce and retail technology solutions on www.find.com. That's FYND. It's a find with a Y. If you want to know why, follow us.